This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And this is James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. Welcome to the latest episode of New World Next Week, our weekly video series that gives you the best in alternative news and open source intelligence, which, of course, you can find all the episodes and other related links and things for flesh out the story for you. As we always say, don't take our word for it. We provide all the stories and documentation that we source. James, so very much to go over this week, and we'll begin by returning to the nuclear situation around the world, and we'll take it from allgov.com, U.S. unprepared for nuclear emergency. The federal agency charged with ensuring the nation's security against disasters admitted last year in a confidential report that the U.S. is ill-prepared to deal with a significant release of radiation. Coming on the heels of Japan's nuclear crisis, the news of the Department of Homeland Security report raises serious concerns about the lack of attention government officials have given to radiation threats, whether it stems from a terrorist attack such as a dirty bomb or a natural disaster impacting a power plant. The Homeland Security study found that the health system can only handle a few radiation injuries at any one time, and that there is no strategy for notifying the public in real time of recommendations on shelter or evacuation priorities. Compounding the lack of preparation is the fact that the federal government 2 years ago ceased stockpiling potassium iodide, the best-known agent to counter radioactive iodine-induced thyroid cancer in young people. Another report is also mentioned in this article, but I want to tie in some of the related updates that, again, kind of flesh this story out. But I will mention that we provide the link to this Homeland Security PDF for you. It's called DHS Strategy for Improving the National Response and Recovery from an Improvised Nuclear Device Attack. So, a related update from allgov.com. Nuke officials worry about plans despite public assurances. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, is not as confident as its public declarations would indicate about the survival of U.S. nuclear reactors against disasters like the kind happening in Japan. This conclusion was reached by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a government watchdog organization, which obtained internal documents from the NRC through the FOIA. UCS officials pointed to commission emails and other records that purportedly show technical staff questioning the effectiveness of key strategy and safety measures adopted for nuclear power plants. And the other related tie-in, James, and I'll throw it back to you. Associated Press poll says 25% are highly confident the U.S. government is prepared for widespread disaster.
Well, there you go. Actually, I tend to think that they are prepared, because it seems to me like they're learning a lot from the Japanese situation. Like, they're learning how to raise radioactivity level, safe recommended radioactivity levels, seemingly arbitrarily. They're learning how to cover up and hide information from the public. They're learning how to obfuscate the real dangers of radiation. I mean, they're learning all sorts of things from this Japanese disaster, and I imagine that makes them more prepared for any crisis back home. But in all seriousness, no, of course, I think it would be naive to think that the government would be reacting much differently than the Japanese government or the Tokyo Electric Power Company is acting in Fukushima. And that's unfortunate, but I wouldn't expect anything different from the government. And on that note, I just had a chance to interview the director of the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility at peer.org, who in April of 2010 was reporting on the EPA's moves to raise their policy action guidelines, their PAGs, about radiation levels. And even back then, there were internal disputes at the EPA among scientists who were saying that basically this was unsafe and that they were putting people at risk by raising these levels like this. And that was a year ago. So, and of course, now we know they're continuing to try to get those PAGs moved up, as we talked about earlier on New World Next Week. So unfortunately, the crisis continues to unfold, and as you say, there's probably no chance that the U.S. government would really be able to react effectively in this type of disaster back home.
Mm-hmm. And as the own elites say out of their own mouths, you know, they never let a crisis go to waste, and of course, it's all about problem, reaction, solution. James, let's now quickly move to our second story, and it'll be the first time we reference one of the newest sites in my growing media monarchy kingdom. And it's holyhexes.com, where I go over religion in society and occult and symbolism and some of those kind of related issues. But from Faith World, France starts ban on full face veil. France's ban on full face veils, a first in Europe, went into force Monday, April 11th, making anyone wearing the Muslim niqab or burqa in public liable to a fine of 150 euros or lessons in French citizenship. Mainstream Muslim groups, which had a six-month grace period after the law was passed to explain it to their supporters, opted not to protest at its entry into force. We've already had our debate about the law, and now our position is clear. We respect French law 100%, said a spokesman for the French Council of the Muslim Faith. Police said they had detained five people, two men, three women, at the small protest in front of Notre Dame Cathedral. The protesters were held for identity checks because their demonstration has not been authorized, not because they were wearing forbidden clothing, a policeman told Reuters. It's so stupid what they've done with this law, because now people will wear the full face veil not out of faith, but because they're looking for a confrontation, said Hager Amir, a 27-year-old Muslim woman. France's 5-million-strong Muslim minority is Western Europe's largest, but fewer than 2,000 women are believed to actually wear a full face veil. Many still oppose the law, however, on the grounds of the precedent that it sets. And two updates, one from The Guardian. First woman fined for wearing niqab, a woman 28 years old, stopped by police in a shopping center of Paris the day the ban came into effect on April 11th. And another update from Reuters, militants seek attacks on France over full veil ban. France's ban on the Muslim full face veils triggered calls on militant online forums for armed retaliation against the country, a U.S.-based terrorism monitoring service said on Wednesday. Some contributors to the messages seen on the password-protected invitation-only militant chat rooms this week called on Al-Qaeda's North African arm to deter France by staging armed attacks, the site, S-I-T-E, service said. James?
Well, let me throw this one right back at you, James. What do you think about this story?
This story is fascinating in that I believe we covered sometime last summer just the growing wave of anti-Muslim hysteria all across Europe and even into the Netherlands. But when we tied in this update with an organization like SITE saying the North African wing of Al-Qaeda, AQIM, which I believe we also referenced quite recently here on NewWorldNextWeek.com, when we start to hear those kind of phrases and those kind of organizations that are suspicious to say the very least, but no time really here to get into all of it. Those are the things that in any story kind of raise red flags for me.
Absolutely agreed. And again, the things that were cited in that article, I think some of those comments were quite informative, like the woman who was saying that basically this is just going to incite people to do this as a form of confrontation rather than as any type of religious thing. So my concern, of course, as always, is that once we give, once we cede any sort of authority or power to the government to tell us what we can and can't do, even if, you know, it means what we can and can't wear, then unfortunately that's a precedent that's been set and can't ever be taken back, or can only be taken back through a great struggle. So again, I'm just opposed to any type of government interference in things like this, and it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily for wearing the ceremonial garb and things. It's just that I just don't think that governments have a place to tell us what to do in our personal lives.
Mm-hmm. And if I wanted to run around all the time wearing some other type of mask or costume, exactly. It's all about being a sovereign individual. And just a quick note on what you said about when the precedents of these types of situations are set, whether we're talking about terrorism and the homegrown paranoia here, that it's, again, catalyzing catastrophic events are used to scare the public with a psychological operation to ratchet up the controls. But when the danger subsides, as it always does, if it ever even existed in the first place, we can never get those controls taken away.
Exactly right. So what's up for story three?
Story three, we're going to boldly go where New World Next Week has never gone before, I believe. We'll take it from The Guardian. FBI destroyed thousands of UFO reports, 1949 memo reveals. The FBI was so overwhelmed with sightings of flying saucers in the 1940s that agents routinely destroyed reports because of lack of filing space, according to documents released by the organization. The policy is outlined in a memo sent on 16th of August, 1949 to J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the Bureau, along with documents on UFOs compiled by agents after statements from witnesses. The note sent by an unnamed FBI agent in San Antonio, Texas, states that the office destroyed UFO reports on the grounds that they arrived in great numbers and contained nothing of FBI interest. It's pointed out that the filing of these would result in the rapid accumulation of very bulky files. These documents are among a batch of papers related to UFO sightings that has been made available through The Vault, the FBI's online records database. In one intriguing note sent on March 22, 322-1950, Special Agent Guy Hotel, head of the FBI's Washington field office, wrote to Hoover with information on three so-called flying saucers that witness claimed had crashed in New Mexico. James, this is, of course, referring to the Roswell incident. And there is more to get into within this story, and ultimately, I think, James, you and I are probably on the same page as far as the alien question goes. I've never seen anything remotely approaching any credible evidence to alien life. I don't doubt it for a moment, but with a couple of related bits here, I think hopefully we can shed a little bit of light. In a seemingly unrelated story, James, from the Associated Press, FBI secret report said Nazi war crimes evidence was probably faked. An FBI report kept secret for 25 years said the Soviet Union quite likely fabricated evidence central to the prosecution of John Demjanjuk, a revelation that could help the defense as closing arguments resumed Wednesday, April 13th, in the retired Ohio auto workers' Nazi war crimes trial in Germany. James, the connection between this, besides it being Nazis and the UFO story, is governments lie, and they lie all the time.
Surprise, surprise, isn't it? But the important point for me about this story, and that's why I hope people will go out and check the post on cyberspacewar.com, is that it really fleshes out the idea that this document from this Guy Hotel, who is writing to FBI Director Hoover about this New Mexico crash, makes it clear that this was this is a memo that's A, been around for a long time and has suddenly been trumpeted in the media, so a lot of people got excited as if this was some new evidence for some alien thing. And B, it's not even about Roswell. You assume it's Roswell because it's New Mexico, but it's actually about a different crash at a different site and then when you actually read about the history and the background of this memo, it's not that this agent is reporting something that he saw with his own eyes. He's reporting something that he got from an informant and deemed to be uncredible, but he's passing it along. So, again, there's so many layers to this, but the important point to me is that it just demonstrates once again how a lot of people jump out of the mainstream media fire straight into the alternative media frying pan and just believe whatever comes along, and without questioning it, without looking at the sources, without looking into the details, without trying to get the background, without trying to get the context, which is exactly why we put the sources for all of our stories in the information bar of this video. And that's why it's really disheartening to see that so few people actually do go back and check the actual sources, because why would you take our word for it? Of course, I'm not trying to mislead you, but how would you know unless you go and actually do this work for yourself and take a look at this and come to your own determination about these stories? So once again, just because the alternative media is saying something doesn't mean it's true, and you have to use your own discernment and your own judgment, and don't ever let anyone else tell you what you should be thinking about any subject.
Very, very well put. James, as we wrap it up here, I do want to make a reference to a lot of this sort of early UFO activity did actually begin here in the Pacific Northwest, and there's interesting stories tying Guy Bannister to the X-Files, the real X-Files, and of course the assassination of John F. Kennedy. But I first heard this story about this quote-unquote new memo from my man Clyde Lewis from right here in Portland, Oregon, of groundzeromedia.org. And I just want to throw out the mention to folks that he's been picked up for a primetime five-night-a-week show from 9 to midnight on pretty much one of the biggest talk stations here in Portland. And he's going to be alongside fantastic hosts like Glenn Beck and Lars Larson and the like. And I'm trying to think of an analogy of what that would be like. It would be like if something like Red Ice Radio got on your local talk station. So it's a fantastic opportunity, I think, to reach a lot of different kind of folks.
Absolutely, but we're fresh out of time. I got to go. James, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.